Welcome to Wellness Spring. In this inspirational episode, I'm joined by the remarkable Graham Saite, CEO and founder of Nutritech Solutions, author, educator, and a passionate voice for restoring the health of our soils and our planet. Graham's journey was inspired by his New Zealand grandfather, a man who taught him the magic of growing food, saving seeds, and nurturing life from the ground up. His path took a profound turn after his daughter's near-fatal accident. However, an experience gave a new meaning to his purpose and inspired a lifetime of service and teaching. From music to microbiology, psychology to soil, Graham shares a deeply human story of resilience, regeneration, and the power of growing life from the ground up. Welcome, Graham, to Wellness Spring. It's so lovely to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm happy to help.
Thank you. And it is wonderful that you have inspired so many people around the world to look beneath their feet and see soil as the true foundation of life for health, our food, and even our planet. So I would like to delve in to your background. And maybe you can let the listeners know where did you grow up and what first sparked your passion for the soil and this incredible pathway that you've taken.
Yes, it was an interesting journey. I came from New Zealand originally. I've been in Australia for the last 35 years, and I have an Australian grandfather, so I was sort of part of both. But I had a grandfather in New Zealand who was a dairy farmer and also a very keen vegetable farmer, and he always put in his crops of potatoes and dug them up and before dug the soil beforehand, and the birds would be circling in huge numbers, and the soil would be wriggling with earthworms. And I do ask that question. Across the world, how many of you have got significant numbers of earthworms in your soil? And it's usually about 1 in 50 who have now got any number of earthworms. And of course, they're a signpost, a really important signpost as to the health of that soil. But my grandfather, in terms of he inspired this love of vegetable production and home food production. And it was, I have these burnt memories of burnt in memories of him sitting, taking his best pumpkin and taking his best tomato and his best bean and drying them in the sun on a plate and putting them in little cardboard packets and storing them in a steel filing cabinet so that the rats wouldn't get them, and basically growing the best from the best. And he was growing the original open pollinated varieties. And it's hugely important for people to understand if they're producing their own food, that that's a really, really important pathway to use the heirloom varieties. The reason being that when we decide we want to patent a certain hybrid and create something different, you can't make more genes. You've got a certain number of genes in the gene pool. And when you create a different shape or a different color or whatever allows you to hybridize that seed, something's lost. And very commonly, the loss relates to nutrition. I work with some of the largest strawberry producers in the world, for example, and they'll acknowledge that two of the most popular varieties can't uptake manganese. If we look at the Green Revolution, where Norman Borlaug won a Nobel Prize, and when he should have probably got a kick up the ass for what he did was, he irradiated rather than normal hybridization. He irradiated wheat and took out a mutant that became our food source. And that mutant uptakes significantly less nutrition than one mineral it doesn't uptake at all. And that mineral is cobalt. And so consequently, many of us are B12 deficient because you can't make B12 without cobalt. So our primary food has been seriously degraded with that particular hybridization. But all hybridized vegetables, if you look at a weed, for example, called purslane, this wonderfully one of the highest sources of vitamin C. It was actually Gandhi's favorite food. It's nastily called pigweed out there, but it's a succulent that tastes really nice. It's got a nice little, you can put it in stir fries, you can put it in anything really. If it hasn't been sprayed, that is, because it is considered a weed, but it has this very innocuous little cream flower. And so we hybridized it and turned it into the landscaping plant portulaca, which has all these purple and yellow and orange flowers. But we got the flowers, and someone was able to patent that, but zero nutrition, all of the nutrient density disappeared. And that's sort of, to varying degrees, what happens in the vegetable garden. And that's why it's a hugely important strategy to grow heirloom varieties, collect the seed, and grow the best from the best. And it just gets better and better. And you are what you eat, and what you eat comes from a soil, and that's very much part of where I come from. So I had this had degrees in psychology and sociology. I was also a musician, and I'd moved to Australia to continue that path and injured my hand and had to go into business. And I'd had kind of a charmed life with three young children and a small farm, and enjoying the children, which many parents don't get a chance to do. Had 5 days a week with them and two very long days running my three businesses at the time. And then my youngest daughter, Rachel, got hit by a car outside of a school and horrifically injured and horrifically brain damaged and lay in a coma for 3 months. And that's kind of life-changing in its own right. But there came a point at which they said, all the machines started beeping, and they said, well, this is a brain death. She will be dead within 4 hours. And so I'm not conventionally religious, but I kind of know there's something there. So I made this deal, first time I'd ever sort of prayed, I guess you'd call it. And basically promised that should she survive against the odds, I would do something of value with the rest of my life. And 20 minutes later, she came out of a coma, and I had this sleepless night deciding what that thing of value. I'd sort of, on this small acreage that I had, I'd just started developing a vague understanding of soils and how they work. When you're sort of a weekend warrior in that sort of scenario, putting in countless hours, I was trying to turn it into a parkland, that 10-acre farm. And lots of work and landscaping and so forth. And the areas that you just banged your head against the wall and you couldn't fix. And someone suggested, why don't you do a soil test? And so I'd not even thought of it. And I did some soil tests, and it was this penny dropping moment that suddenly I understood where I'd put those countless hours and how that could be fixed. And so I'd developed this embryonic interest in soil. And when I had my sleepless night, the night after Rachel came out of the coma, I decided I'd become an expert in soil, plant, animal, and human nutrition. Now, I didn't realize in those early stages the profound link between soil health and planetary health. And as that became more and more obvious, I began traveling to the point of 30 countries a year prior to COVID, frantically trying to spread the word and share the message of the link between soil. And that link, quite simply, is that there's only a certain number of carbon molecules on the planet, and they're stored in three places. The largest storehouse by far is the soil, where it's stored as organic carbon or humus, and also in inorganic forms like calcium carbonate, magnesium carbonate, and so forth. Then it's the carbon-based life forms, the plants, the animals, the humans, the trees, and so forth. And then it can become the gaseous form. And the carbon, same molecules that have been here since the start of all time, you can't make more. They cycle between those three places. And we've gone from 5% organic matter globally in the last 10 or 12 decades down to 1.5%. And that represents almost double the amount of CO2 we've put up from coal and oil and industry and motor vehicles and so forth. So a really simple strategy is to put it back where it came from. And if you can build organic matter in your soil rather than the current model of constantly losing small amounts each year, now, that is direct carbon sequestration. You can't make new carbon. If you took your organic matter from 2% to 3%, you stepped into the carbon cycle and sequestered what otherwise would have gone up into the atmosphere. So it's, there, of course, there's now carbon credits for achieving that goal, and it's rapidly becoming a secondary income stream for farmers. And it's a wonderful scenario because it turns out that when we look at the importance of organic matter in the soil, and we look at one of the studies conducted by one of our major banks, when they looked at what determines profitability, they wanted to review that because they'd had giving loans to people to get bigger. The dominant mantra is get bigger or get out, and loaning money to farmers to buy their neighbor's farm. And too many of those loans were falling over. So they reviewed the situation, and to the surprise of the researchers in the Hillston region in New South Wales, on 800 farms for 3 years, the absolute determinant, the primary determinant of your profitability, was the percentage of organic matter in your soil. And that sort of heralds the potential golden era of agriculture, that you're going to be paid to produce the very thing that makes you more profitable. So it's a nice outcome, but it's a hugely important one. And people say, well, why do farmers need to be compensated to save the planet. They've got children and grandchildren, surely. But the reality is that in this brave new world of climate change farming that's getting more and more difficult, there's more and more extremes. It's getting harder to farm, and farmers do need some compensation and some motivation to move in this direction and build carbon rather than losing it. So that's the short story of how I decided on that sleepless night that I'd developed this expertise. I'd been an A student back in the day, so I had a good brain and not really used it for anything other than myself and business and my family, and decided that would change and I'd do something of value. So the day after my brother came to see Rachel, and we went down that day and formed Nutritech Solutions, and the journey has been, but that was 32 years ago almost to the day, and we're now in 52 countries, and I'm walking the talk and living up to my promise as much as I can and enjoying every moment. It's not a sacrifice. I've just come back from a 4-week seminar tour of the east coast of Australia, and there's really good, super engaged crowds everywhere and really informed questions because people have got into the video series and my podcast and so forth, and really it's like talking to a bunch of agronomists often in the rooms. It's really changed. There's a huge increased awareness, and I spend a day in the classroom and a day on personal consults on farm. So I totally enjoy that on-farm visits because you're always learning. Doesn't matter how much knowledge you've accumulated, every time you visit a farm you learn something new with that farmer growing his crop and his conditions and the things that he's learned that work and don't work, and it's all part of the joy of this whole journey. So I totally love it. That was a long answer.
Oh my God, you've unpacked so much there. I'm glad that was your short answer.
Yeah.
As I'm a health and wellness advocate, and I come from a nursing background, both registered nurse and psychiatric, it picked my interest when you spoke about your daughter, Rachel. Oh
yes.
My goodness, how her raising that must have been like terrifying. What was
yes.
going through your mind? I know you prayed and made that deal with God or whoever this beautiful intelligence is floating around the universe.
Yes, well, I mean, it was harrowing because, you don't sort of factor in when you're signed up as an organ donor that you're going to be approached on every second day almost by doctors and sometimes more than one of them telling you about little Susie who's waiting on her eyes or little Jane who's waiting on her kidneys. And telling you that she's not going to be anything but a vegetable if she survives at all, and can they turn the machines off? So it was a huge kind of decision-making time for us at that point anyway, and we hung in there and kind of hoped. And then in that desperation when it looked like all hope was gone, I just sort of, made that deal, and then 20 minutes later she
but
came
what
out of the
did
coma.
You do
like,
stop praying did you stop praying or what did you do?
No, I just basically in my head said, here's the deal. As if I was talking to someone, she survives. I did,
yeah.
I use my skills just for the benefit of others rather than myself. And so that was the start of the journey. And it's been a wonderful journey because it's kind of, you can't get what you don't give. And the more you give, the more you get back. And it's been this wonderful trip from there on in. So people say, it must be a great sacrifice for you to be putting all this effort in and traveling all over. But it's just wonderful. It's like an honor to be able to do this work, and retain the passion that I had on day one. In fact, I've probably got more passionate as the years have gone by, and I've realised how important this message is. So, yeah, that's where I come from.
Wow! And so she went from being you were told by the doctors that she could be a vegetable, even if she did live, she'd be brain dead, and so forth. To a remarkable 100% recovery from
no,
what
not,
you're
not, not, not
100%
into. Recovery. No, she came out of the coma, but I mean, she had massive brain injuries and so forth. So, no, it was certainly not 100% recovery. I mean, she wasn't supposed to walk or talk, and it took quite some while to get her walking and a few months till she started talking. And she speaks about a third slower, and she has about half the memories that she had previously. And she's paralyzed on one arm as the side effect of the injury, because the brain left brain, and she's right arm is paralyzed. But the good news is that she is the most joyful of my five children. So You want a dose of joy, you go and see Rachel. I call it Joy Central to go around her place because she loves every minute of life. So that's what life's about, you know, how much peace and happiness you enjoy on the journey. And so I'm permanently grateful for that and you know, happy to be doing something worthwhile in the name of that recovery. So, yeah.
Yeah. And what else interested me was that you're still so passionate about your work. And I'm sure this is inspired by the gratitude for Rachel. And it's lovely to hear that she is so full of joy, because most people today are striving for inner peace and harmony. And, you know, the joy that comes from being in that special place.
No, it's very true. It's when you get to the last stages of life, assuming you're not zonked out on morphine or something, there's often a clarity that comes through, and the realization for many is that the measure of a good life is how much peace and harmony you enjoyed in that short period. And one of the questions I ask as I travel the world teaching, and I ask it in most classrooms, and I would have asked tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people, and sometimes in India I have as many as 2,000 people come along to talks. But I ask the question, how many of you can say in all honesty you don't feel stress and anxiety on a regular basis you'd rather not feel? Who can tell me they're stress-free? Well, what's interesting is that no one even turns around to see if there's anyone, because there never is anyone. It doesn't matter what part of the world, you can be on a peaceful island somewhere like Norfolk Island or whatever, and it's the same response as everyone. We've created this ridiculous world, really, where everyone's stressed and anxious, and basically that's the opposite of what you're here for. You're here for to be and to enjoy as much peace and happiness as possible, and the opposite of that is stress and anxiety. So it's kind of a crazy world in that context, and I have that kind of philosophical part of the teachings on how we can de-stress and how we can see things a little differently, and it's all part of the story. So there's a huge component in my longer courses, particularly in the human health side, because I had this life-changing experience with one of my great mentors, a wonderful consultant who's no longer with us, a guy called Jerry Brunetti. I was traveling in a tour with Jerry Brunetti and Gary Zimmer, who are two key sort of leading lights in this movement. I was very much the junior partner in that tour that was called the Three Up Tour. And we stopped in South Australia and did some talks, and we were heading to West Australia. And I called my aging parents in New Zealand. And Mum said, "You'd better have a talk to Dad because you might not hear his voice again." I said, "What?" And she said, "You know, he's got this problem with his parathyroid gland. And the only solution from that perspective, when it starts malfunctioning and calcium becomes a problem and can cause calcification and so forth, because your body can no longer manage calcium accurately without the parathyroid gland." And so they were going to remove it. And when they did back in the day, now they've got more sort of laser guided surgery and so forth, but this is a lot of years back, 25 years ago. Very often they nick the voice box, and consequently you don't hear you know, they've got to use an artificial voice from there on. And so hence her comment. Well, I hopped in the plane to fly to Perth, and I mentioned to Jerry about Dad having his operation the following week. And he said, "You have checked his boron levels, haven't you?" And I said, "No, why?" And he said, "Well, the parathyroid gland malfunctions in the absence of boron." So I called them frantically and had to twist their arms to cancel the operation the following week, and said, "I'd pay for the tests." And so we did, urine, blood, and hair. And basically we couldn't find boron. It was barely measurable. So he started taking his 3 milligrams a day of boron, and it took about 6 weeks and the parathyroid returned to normal. And I had this huge realization in the modern medical machine, where a degree involves maybe 30 minutes to an hour of nutrition, you know, you really are not equipped to get back and solve things at the root cause level. And how many times do we pull out the scalpel because we don't understand the story? And so I decided that would be part of my mission, was that I would, you know, develop some expertise in how the human body works and nutrition generally. And so I lecture, and there's many, many hints and tips and strategies about how you can live a longer, happier, healthier life that has become as popular as my soil health talks. So I talk at length on all sorts of things. And there's so many things that really should be taught at primary school level that are so important that people just don't understand about how they can look after themselves better than what we are currently.
Wow. Yeah, going back to the farmers and the people you're teaching as you're traveling and stress and anxiety. It's so prevalent around the world at the moment, and I've started doing weekly talks on stress and anxiety and overwhelm. And when Brian and I were traveling in our camper van around Australia, we were amazed at how many people were stressed, and to discover that once every 10 days a farmer commits suicide, you
yes,
know.
It's a terrible story. And that there was actually some figures released a few years back by the rural press who control all of the rural newspapers and so forth. They put out this little bulletin called Farmers' Health, and they published for the first time that I'm familiar with the statistics on farmers' health versus the other professions. And it was literally double the levels of most degenerative diseases. It was 2.5 times the level of prostate cancer to the next closest. It was 3 times the level of depression and alcoholism, and 4 times the level of suicide of the next closest profession. So it was a terrible indictment of the clean green profession that it was anything but. And so, you know, I've made it very much my role. I consider farmers to be literally the most important profession. There is nothing more important than food production. And, you know, I've made it my role to try and help look after them a little better than what they're currently being looked after, and teach them the sort of tools to look after themselves a little better. And as I say, it's become as popular, that side of my story and my teaching, as the soil health and plant health and so forth story. So, yeah, hugely important.
I'm so delighted to hear that. And farmers, in my opinion, are the most important people in the world. And as you said, we are what you eat. I'd also like to add, eat, think, and drink, because we have so many negative,
yes,
disempowering beliefs going over and over and over and over.
Exactly.
And can you tell us a bit more about nutrient density and the work that you're doing with that? And why is nutrient density important for people? Because today, so many people just buy the shiny apple in the supermarket and not knowing that it's been sprayed with chemicals and so forth.
No, so there's two different equations there. One of them is the chemical contamination story, but the nutrient dense story is we literally are what we eat, and what we eat comes from a soil that's a shadow of what it used to be. We had this German chemist who analyzed the ash from plant matter 10 or 12 decades back and determined that it largely consisted of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. We realized there were armaments factories lying dormant at the time and that we could make these three core ingredients. And rather than what we'd done forever for thousands of years, which was sort of a cyclical model, always involving animals and things were cycled back through, and understanding that the first cell that oozed from the Precambrian ocean had 74 minerals and that there are no accidents in the perfect blueprint called nature. And so suddenly we started taking a little bit off as we do, but we were cycling with the animals, so you're getting a little bit returned all the time. We started taking off a little bit of everything with each crop and putting back just three things. We really dumbed down nutrition at that point. We literally moved into the NPK model with nothing else for a long while. So we mined our soils for a considerable period. And then about 12 to 15 years after the widespread adoption of that simplistic NPK nutrition, we started to see pest and disease pressure unlike anything we'd seen before. And rather than recognizing that perhaps it was linked to this dumbed down nutrition, science stepped up the plate and said, look, we can create these rescue chemicals. And so began the dawn of chemical agriculture, where we treat our problems with chemicals. But what we need to understand is that we've increased the use of those chemicals every year since we started. So last year was a 14.7% increase in total chemical usage. The previous year, 14.4%. Year before that, 14.1, 13.9, 13.6, 13.2, every single year for 10 decades, more and more chemicals into the equation. But wait for it, every year, without exception, more and more pest and disease pressure. It's literally the definition of unsustainable, putting more and more on, you know, for less and less response. And particularly when we talk about economic sustainability, because more and more is costing more and more. And there are farmers everywhere who are hitting the wall with that model and recognizing. I was touring and talking to the blueberry growers, and they were talking about, you know, younger guys who'd taken over from their dad in that industry. And they said, look, we're just putting more and more on for less and less response, and it's getting more and more costly for those chemicals. And they're banging their heads against the wall and looking for an alternative. And of course, that alternative is understanding that plants require balanced nutrition, and nutrition is minerals, microorganisms, and humus. And I call it nutrition farming, this whole approach. And it's minerals, microorganisms, and humus, and how those three things interrelate. And it's not that complex to understand that there are certain ratios of minerals that we seek. We talk about this very simple process that you're managing. The most important thing that you begin to manage when you grow a crop is called gas exchange. So how freely does oxygen diffuse, which is gases got moved from a high concentration to a low concentration automatically, and it's called diffusion. So oxygen diffuses into the soil. The roots and the organisms, oxygen is the single most important element for plant growth and for microbial health and for human health for that matter. The oxygen is utilized, and then the organisms and the roots, the organisms around the roots and the roots themselves breathe out, and they breathe out CO2. And so CO2 now is in a concentrated form in the soil. So it diffuses, moves from a high concentration to a low concentration. The plant leaves waiting little pores on its underside of the leaf called stomates. And those stomates suck up the CO2, and it's combined with water and sunlight in this almost miraculous process called photosynthesis. And that's how you grow stuff. In fact, it's where we all come from. The glucose that's produced from photosynthesis is a building block of all carbon-based life forms, including us. So it is the single most important process on the planet, this process of photosynthesis. And it's driven by how well you've managed gas exchange. So how friable and open is your soil to allow oxygen in and CO2 out. And very, very commonly, there are two things that govern that friability, that breathability of the soil. One of them is called the calcium to magnesium ratio, because calcium is this very large beach ball of an ion that pushes the clay apart. And magnesium is this tiny, much, much smaller ion that pulls the clay in and makes it so that you're walking around on platform shoes in the wet. And so there's this ratio between those two minerals. And you could argue, well, I'll just do calcium. I'll open up the soil. I'll flocculate the soil, it's called, with calcium and forget magnesium. But you can't forget magnesium, because your second role, so your first role is you're managing gas exchange. How freely does the oxygen come in and the CO2 come out of that soil? And your second role is that you're managing chlorophyll, the green pigment in the leaf. You do not want blotches and pale colors and stripes. That's called chlorosis. You're aiming for this perfectly evenly green plant, which means you've got maximum numbers of sugar factories making a maximum amounts of glucose, feeding some of that glucose to the organisms. And the better you do that, the better you do. So you're managing magnesium, and it's called calcium, and it's called the calcium to magnesium ratio. And that varies based on whether you've got a light soil where you need more magnesium to give some structure to a soil that has none, to a heavy clay soil where you might be as much as 7 parts calcium to 1 part magnesium, because you need more calcium to open up all that clay. So the calcium to magnesium ratio is the single most important ratio in terms of that physical link to gas exchange, that most important role that you're performing. The second link is a second ratio, and it's a biological ratio. It's called the fungi to bacteria ratio. So bacteria spit out sticky substances that create tiny little crumbs in the soil, and fungi with their hyphae wrap those up into much larger aggregates. And that's called crumb structure, and that's the perfect soil. It doesn't get any better. You can run your arm down to your elbow. It smells like you could eat the stuff. The earthworms move through freely. The oxygen comes in. The CO2 comes out. The water, of course, it's called infiltration, very important word in the brave new world of climate change farming. Water infiltrates so much more efficiently in a soil with a good CalMag ratio and a good fungi to bacteria ratio to have that soil open and friable. So those are the two simple, really quite simple. The better you do those two things, you manage your fungi to bacteria ratio, you manage your calcium to magnesium ratio, the better you do. It's really as simple as that. And the problem with the fungi to bacteria ratio is that there is now a simple little tool called a microbiometer, which should be on everyone's Christmas tree list. It's less than $300 for that unit. And it measures two things in your soil. It measures something called the total microbial biomass, which is how big is your workforce, and there's no exceptions. Your best block will have the highest microbial biomass without exception. And it measures that all-important second thing called the fungi to bacteria ratio. And what we see is that the vast majority of soils everywhere have got 90% bacteria and 10% fungi, and what they should have is 50% of each. It's a one-to-one ratio that heralds a breathing soil that you would do well with. And so then we teach how you can change that ratio and how you can open up that soil and make it more friable so the oxygen comes in more freely and so forth. And so that's a very simple starting point to nutrition farming and how it works. We've got the two ratios, the fungi to bacteria ratio, the calcium to magnesium ratio. You fix those and that's a wonderful start.
It's easy for you to say that's simple, but for a new farmer like myself starting out, and even gardeners, people at home with gardens that can grow, you know, how would we do that? I'm going to ask Father Christmas to buy me one of those microbiome meters.
Yes,
And
wonderful.
I know I've started a compost. And we did buy a soil test kit and we were depleted in quite a few things, but can you say what's good to grow to get the land healthy and so forth?
Well, I mean, part of the story, if you look at the definition of the word science in Webster's dictionary, the definition of science is adherence to natural laws and principles. So it's quite simple. You've got a perfect blueprint called nature, and you're supposed to learn from that blueprint and work with it. And what we said in our arrogance was, we could do better than that. Well, you can't do better than that. And we're on our knees staring down the abyss and thinking that we could do better than perfect. So if you look at nature and genuinely learn from that marvel, what's the central driving principle of nature becomes the first question. And it's quite simple. The central driving principle is called biodiversity. Nature is the more the merrier is how nature works. And when we look at plants and we look at this phenomenon called cocktail cover cropping, which I've just finished this tour of the East Coast and we're on many farms during that time. And it's just become the strategy that so many people have adopted so successfully. I mean, it is just a tremendous way to drought-proof your farm, to have some multi-species, you know, it's called pasture cropping, where you direct drill a whole variety of other species into the soil. But the finding is that the plants, the most important process we mentioned is photosynthesis, and plants make this glucose building block, and they pump half of it down because the roots need it for everything they do in conjunction with minerals. They use glucose and minerals together. And then, interestingly, 60% of what's pumped down the roots is actually pumped out from the roots. You know, it's the most important precious substance of the plant, and yet it gives its total of 30% of its total, 60% of what goes to the roots, which is half, is 30% of everything is given away to the organisms. And there at the most important process on the planet, the nexus of that most important process is the most important principle. And that principle is quite simply, give and you shall receive. And that is a universal principle that applies to us as much as it applies to many, many things in nature. And when you say, well, how does it apply to me? Well, it's interesting because I lecture on longevity science, and we know that, you know, if you want that extra 10 to 15 years, that it's really specific exercise regimes, including things like resistance exercises and interval training and so forth that release human growth hormone. We know that it's very specific dietary requirements, and we know that it's informed supplementation. So there's three key things that there's the whole science of longevity is based on. But last March, there was a book released in Australia with some science behind it, suggesting that there's a fourth thing that can determine longevity that's equally as important as the other three. And that fourth thing, surprisingly, is volunteering. They've discovered that, and then, of course, this is the principle of giving you shall receive. People volunteer when they've got, you know, got the time, they retire perhaps, and they volunteer for the first time. And after a month or two, they're saying, what is this feeling I'm feeling? I've not experienced this before. And they're feeling a sense of peace and harmony they haven't experienced before, because you don't get what you don't give. And that's the law of give and receive. And there it is. And the whole concept of living an extra 10 or 15 years, volunteering is one of the four things that determine that, very interestingly. So, yeah, that's just a long answer to a short question again. So back to that story of the plant giving away 30% of its total glucose that it produces. It doesn't just give away glucose. Every plant has a unique requirement, and this is the whole story of biodiversity. Every plant feeds, you know, if I'm growing bananas, as I do amongst many crops on my subtropical farm, I have two farms, one up in the temperate regions of Stanthorpe and one down here on the coast, on the Sunshine Coast. So I just have a mouthful of water. So I grow bananas amongst other things, and I show in my courses the very specific requirements that differ for every plant. Every plant has a greater need for zinc or manganese or boron or whatever. If you're a legume, you've got very high need for calcium and boron, for example. And so the plants don't just give sugar, they lace that glucose giveaway with whatever they want to stimulate to deliver their particular requirements. So if you're a banana giving away your sugars, then you've got this very, very high need for manganese. So you introduce some substances that stimulate manganese-reducing organisms who will deliver your requirements. So the bottom line is the greater diversity above ground, because they're all feeding different organisms to deliver different things, the greater the diversity below ground. And nature says, you beauty, this is what I want. And that's, you know, what we've done. And as I say, many things we've done under that definition of science is adherence to natural laws and principles. Many things we've done are anything but. You know, I mean, monoculture is the opposite of what nature wants. And so how you can counter that, I've got an apple and stone fruit orchard at Stanthorpe, is one of my farms. How you counter that is you put multi-species cover crops into the interrow and bring back that diversity that nature so desperately requires. And that applies the same in your veggie garden or under your fruit trees or whatever, that this diversity is the huge story. The more the merrier is basically what nature wants. So it's a wonderful strategy. And so then within that model, if we're talking about, say, trying to improve that fungi to bacteria ratio, there's a really important thing. So if you're vegetable gardening, if you've ever sort of looked into permaculture principles, for example, you'll know that one of their strategies is that you plant functional legumes, particularly lucerne plants, throughout your veggie or throughout your orchard, and then they become this cut and drop plant, because there's actually no mulch known to man that's better than lucerne mulch. So you grow your own lucerne mulch, but the plant itself, legumes have a really important role, ecosystem role it's called. First of all, of course, they house these little organisms and nodules on their roots, these organisms called rhizobium, that give you free nitrogen. Of course, they utilize the nitrogen for themselves, the legume, and then they give up once they've developed themselves, then they give some of that nitrogen to the neighboring plants. But all legumes release an acid exudate from their roots, and that breaks apart two minerals that tie up very quickly in the soil, which are called calcium and phosphorus. And it turns out that when we look at this hugely important thing called photosynthesis, the single most important two minerals for photosynthesis are calcium and phosphorus. And here you've got a plant that's releasing the two of them and making them available to the surrounding plants or trees if it's an orchard and so forth. So you're getting free nitrogen, you're getting free calcium, you're getting free phosphorus, three hugely important minerals. And then there's a fourth benefit from legumes. And that fourth benefit is that they release this acid exudate constantly from their roots, and that's what fungi love. And so fungi absolutely thrive beneath a legume. And you will find with that meter that if you take soil off a legume roots, you'll have double the counts of fungi. So the trick to one of the tricks to bringing back and improving your fungal component is that you must have functioning legumes, and herein lies the catch, because most, not most, but about half of the legumes that I look at when I walk fields or in gardens for that matter, are non-functioning legumes. And so they're doing nothing. They're just a parasite sitting there doing nothing in the scheme of things. So what determines their functioning is that, for a start, they have to have nodules, and about half of them don't have, and that's a lack of sulfur. It can be other things, but sulfur's the biggest player. See, we used to get sulfur for free. It came down as acid rain, and then we found that acid rain was killing forests and waterways around the world, so we banned it completely, and farmers haven't caught up with the fact that you don't get it for free anymore. And gardeners have not caught up with it. And sulfur is deficient everywhere you look. And if you've got a sufficient deficiency, then you can't nodulate on your legumes. And so you haven't got the nodules. If you haven't got the nodules, you haven't got the organisms fixing nitrogen. If you haven't got that happening, you haven't got the acid exudate. So there's no breaking apart of calcium and phosphate, and there's no feeding your fungi. There's nothing. It's just a parasite plant in the paddock. So that's number one. You've got to have nodules. So you've got to get on your knees, dig up, and see that you've got little nodules on the roots. And number two, those nodules must have a red pigment inside them when you squeeze them or squash them on a sheet of white paper. And that red pigment is called leg hemoglobin, just like the pigment in our red blood. And if you haven't got that red color, then it's a non-functioning legume that is not fixing nitrogen, it's not releasing acid exudates, it's not feeding fungi, it's not breaking apart locked up calcium and phosphate and delivering those minerals to the surrounding plants. And again, over half of the fields you walk, they might have nodules, but they're white inside instead of red. And so that all comes down to a tiny little trace mineral called molybdenum, which is lacking in 80% of the soils that we look at. And we work in 52 countries, so we see a tremendous number of soil tests. And molybdenum is a very leachable little trace mineral. You only need a couple of cups per hectare of sodium molybdate, but it's stored in humus, and we've lost 2/3 of our humus. We've gone from 5% down to 1.5%, and no one ever put it back. So it's missing in many soils. And if you haven't got that trace mineral, then you've got non-functioning legumes, and you're not feeding fungi amongst the other benefits that come from legumes. So it's, you know, it's not simple, but it's fixable for everyone to understand these principles. Whether you're a home gardener or a farmer, it can make a huge difference to realize this, fix it, give them some sulfur, spray some molybdenum, it's only small amounts that will get that plant functioning again, and then it's feeding the fungi and delivering all those other benefits. So that's, you know, it's getting back to root causes and solving problems rather than treating symptoms with chemicals. We know that model's a failure. We've talked about agriculture, more and more chemicals, less and less response. We look at the human health story and we see the largest killer remains coronary heart disease, followed very closely by cancer, which will probably take over by the end of next year. But the third killer forever has been stroke, and stroke's now been relegated to number four. The new third killer is prescription medicine. I mean, it's a ludicrous indictment of a symptom treating approach that our medicine has become our third largest killer. If we look at Americans, at 60, they're on 18 medications, and by 65, they're on 24 medications on average. And multiple drug therapy kills you, as that do long-term any drugs are negative over accumulated periods, and that's been our model. We just treat symptoms. You know, if you've got high blood pressure, there's a reason for that. Very commonly it's linked to either an underfunctioning kidney, or it's linked to magnesium deficiency. It's hugely linked to high blood pressure, but the doctors don't look at that. They just give you medication for the now till the day you die. As soon as you stop it, your blood pressure comes back. And look at the, just Google the long-term effects of that model. So just back to that nutrition and nutrient density and its importance. The simple thing to understand is that you think, oh, well, I can just take my nutrients from a bottle. And you need to understand that food is a huge different delivery mechanism of nutrition. It's how, where you're supposed to get nutrition. The founder of modern medicine, Hippocrates, said, let your food be your medicine and your medicine be your food. And we're discovering how profoundly accurate that guy was on a daily basis, because there are so many studies coming through with all of these compounds in food, these medicinal compounds. And, you know, if you look, for example, just an example of food as medicine versus taking it from a bottle, the vast majority of us in this country is selenium deficient. And your most important organ is not your heart, it's your liver. Your heart's a close second. And the most important mineral for that most important organ is called selenium. And we tested in the soils, it's not there. You know, we're second lowest in the world in Australia. The CSIRO tested selenium in a study in Virginia for 6 months. They tested for selenium in food grown in South Australia. They couldn't find a single part per billion. There was nothing, zero, zilch. So everyone needs to supplement with selenium. And if you were to say, okay, well, you know, what is there as a natural source of selenium? If I didn't want to take my 200 micrograms a day from the chemist shop, then by far the highest source of selenium is the Brazil nut. And it gives us the perfect example of food as medicine, because there are six things that govern the uptake and utilization of selenium in our bodies, and all of them are in the Brazil nut. The most powerful cofactor, as it's called, of those six is called vitamin E. And of course, the Brazil nut's filled with it because that's what it is. It's God-given medicine. It was food as medicine. So the Brazil nut is the way that you supplement your. And of course, if you can put it into a green smoothie and micronize it, so that, because most of us don't chew enough to access all of that nutrition, let the 2-horsepower blender do that chewing for you, that's a wonderful way to address your selenium deficiency. But that's just an example of food as medicine. So we've created the scenario where we mined a lot of our minerals, that mineral delivery is linked to microorganisms, and we've slaughtered the microorganisms with a chemical barrage that's gone into our soils. And so the food is not what it used to be. There are multiple published papers. There's Anne-Marie Meyer's book that's chronicled since 1950, this dramatic drop in key minerals present in our food. But it's not just the minerals, it's the phytonutrients. I mean, I was talking to the minister in the UK pre-COVID for 3 hours up at Parliament House, the ag minister in the UK. And he cited a study of oranges in the UK where they actually found 20% of oranges tested had zero vitamin C. You think, I had my orange juice, I got my vitamin C. Maybe you did. It depends on how that food was grown. We know that the measurement of antioxidants is called the ORAC score, and that should really be stamped on every carton of everything because it can be quite relatively easily tested now. But it's not legal to call food medicine and to quote medicinal values to food on cartons or on labels. But blueberries, for example, are, in the 6,000s normally in what's called the ORAC score, the measurement of antioxidants. But you can find blueberries that are 900, depends on how you grew the blueberry. So nutrient density is what determines our health, and there's a huge, massive variation based on how that food was grown. And the quality of the food's based on the quality of the soil, and the soil's, a shadow of what it used to be. But it's not just a lack of nutrition, this progressive degeneration that we're saying. If we look at the work of some of the nutritional anthropologists, where they toured the world, and we're talking about Western Price and so forth, and they looked at the health and vitality of various cultures historically and at the time, sort of thing. And the very first thing they looked at was the jawbones from when they could gain access to skeletons and so forth to see how evenly the teeth fitted. And I think of myself as a child at classroom of 45 in New Zealand, in Inglewood and Taranaki, and we had two kids with glasses and one kid with braces, and they were called Four Eyes and Metal Mouth with the cruelty of children at the time. My son, interestingly, with 45 children in Noosa, had a classroom where 30% of the kids had braces and 40% of them had glasses. I mean, that's a prime example. Braces is something your jaw didn't fill out to fit your teeth in it, and that's the progressive degeneration we're seeing in the new generation, which is going to live less, a shorter period than us. And that's never happened in the history of humankind, that our children are going backwards, and that's called progressive degeneration. If we look at Francis Pottinger's work with part of that story is the consumption of dead processed food. And what Pottinger showed us with 900 cats in a book called 900 Cats that chronicles that research, he took these cats and half of them over three generations were given just processed food. So pasteurized milk, biscuits and tinned food, and the others were given raw milk, raw fish, raw meat and so forth, which cats were designed to eat. And they chronicled their progression. And by generation three, half of the kittens were born dead and none of them lived longer than a month. It was this terrible downhill path with, that extreme version of only processed food. But I can walk behind you in the supermarket and tell you the health of your family. I wouldn't, but sometimes I feel like making comments because there's obviously issues there, based on how much processed food is in that trolley. It's just very, very simple. I mean, how do you keep food in this football field-sized stadium called a supermarket? How does the cornflakes sit for 2 years on the shelf? You put a food grade stabilizer in it, and you say, "Well, that sounds innocuous." No, it's not. It's a biocide that kills single celled organisms, and you've got a gut full of those organisms that determine every aspect of your health. So the more of that processed food you eat, the sicker you will be, because there is nothing that's not linked to gut health. Everything comes back to the health of your gut. 85% of your immune system learns from the gut organisms. I was at a conference recently where a woman was doing work on manic depression, and a large number of people involved in the study of long-term sufferers of that horrible disease where you're up 1 minute and contemplating suicide the next, and it's incurable. And she was looking at fecal transplants. And so, of course, the concept of finding someone bomb-proof, paying them to poo, brewing their organisms and putting a tube up the bottom of the receiver and changing completely the microbiome. Well, she was soon to publish an 82.6% cure rate of long-term manic depression based upon putting someone else's complete system. So, you hear the story of the gut as a second brain. Well, there's a prime example of it. The gut health is huge. It's everything. And we increasingly recognize there's so many studies now coming about the importance of nurturing the human microbiome. And so it's, we've assaulted that system in very much the same way we've assaulted the organisms in the soil with the barrage of chemicals. There's two things, I'll just complete that story. There's two things we should have been told and haven't been told with the food contamination, the chemical contamination. Yes, we did the research and showed you could get away with 4 parts per million of diethane or 5 parts per million of glyphosate on food. And the guinea pig didn't die in that 3-month trial. But there's two things we weren't told. One of them's called bioaccumulation. and no one's ever mentioned it, but how does your most important organ, your liver, manage, which is, you know, your liver's charged with this two-stage detoxification system, and it's geared so that it can actually neutralize most naturally occurring contaminants. It can have some attempt at neutralizing. It could be mercury or arsenic or whatever. They're all natural. And half of the chemicals that we spray onto our food are derived from natural compounds. We synthesized something that we found worked in nature and dumbed it down a little bit usually, but and that's what we've utilized. But slightly over half of what we created, and the liver looks at that new structure coming and says, what the bloody hell is that thing? And it pumps it off and stores it in our fat cells. And that's why if you're overweight, you don't lose fat weight too quickly, because you get really sick when you release those chemicals. So in a study in the US, the 1,400 kids, 700 from towns, 700 from rural areas, they looked at the 13 most commonly used farm chemicals, fungicides, pesticides, herbicides, nematicides, the wormicide that every cattle producer uses, or most of them. And they looked at the 1,400 kids, half from the town, half from the city, to see, you know, they looked at urine, blood and tissue. And to the horror of the research, they couldn't find one child who didn't have unacceptable levels of all 13 chemicals. It was a horror show. And you know, we know that the largest killer of our kids is childhood leukemia. And we know that there is no debates about the link between environmental chemicals and that particular quite new disease. So my argument is that we can do it better, then we should be learning how to do it better. And that's what I teach. That's a short story.
Oh my God. So much to unpack there.
It's called drinking from the fire hose when you hear me talk. That's what people call it, because it's just like this for hours. I talk for 10 hours a day, just like this. This is a nonstop outpouring of information. But as long as you can pick up the trends, is what I argue, and pick up the key concepts of the interrelationship between everything, and there's always going to be a few simple take-home tips that you can utilize. So, yeah, that's how I talk and what I do.
You're like a walking encyclopedia. And I know everybody will benefit from listening to your podcast shows and doing your training courses. And I love the ethos that you come from with doing volunteering, because I teach people and say being of service is the highest vibration ever, because you're not thinking about me, and you're doing everything from your heart.
Yes,
and as you said about comorbidities, and especially in children, and when you talked about the fecal matter, I know lots of studies have been done with children with autism, you know.
Yes.
And they've done many studies about that, which I won't delve into now, because I'm just trying to do a quick summary and just bring on the nodules. That's what I'm going to be looking at. And so what is, Graham, just to wrap up, because I'm looking at the time, and just to wrap up, what is your number one health and wellness go-to for yourself?
Good question. Number one. At this point, for me, it's probably the importance of movement and exercise, because I'm constantly, at least I move around a bit when I'm on stage, but, you know, I desperately need to find more time to enable that daily exercise. It's just so important as you get older. It's just massively important. And I need to look after myself a little bit better, because I just dedicate all my time to helping others. So you can overdo that, and it probably shortens the time you're going to be here. So I probably need to step up the plate and improve that side. But of course, I think green smoothies are a very simple strategy. So many of us need to alkalize. And of course, the whole acid alkaline balance is based on how much protein you consume, which is driven by phosphorus and sulfur, the two acid forming minerals, versus how much of the alkalizing minerals you consume in your diet, which of course is fruit and vegetables. And the alkalizing minerals are calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium. And they come from fruit and vegetables. And a great sort of strategy on multiple fronts is to take your kale or silver beet or spinach or whatever and blend it with a high power blender. The faster you can blend it, the less the damage there is for the active components. So you use a Vitamix or a Thermablend or whatever, a 2-horsepower blender, to do it quickly. And you put your berries, and I put all forms of berries in there. And your bananas, perhaps, and you can put probiotics in there. You can put prebiotics in there. I put some Yakon because Yakon's the most powerful prebiotic, and I put my product BioBubble, which is a very good probiotic. So it just becomes this incredible start to the day, with, you know, that alkalizing effect and that whole suite of antioxidants that just kicks you into energy for the day. And it's one of my favorite strategies for health.
Fabulous. And where's the best place for people to contact you? Is it via your website, the NutriTech Solutions?
Yes. Well, I mean, if they Google the Nutrition Farming Podcast, they can see the five seasons of the podcast and access them. There's also a YouTube channel. It's called the How to Do It channel on YouTube, where I teach just for 15 minutes for each video. And that's in its fourth or fifth season now. Has many, many tens of thousands of viewers, but it teaches you all the little strategies in the garden for yourself, lots of health strategies, and of course for farmers, all kind of concepts of how you can brew living fertilizers up on your farm and so forth. So otherwise there's the www.nutritech.com.au website with hundreds of articles, and we've got a new app that's coming out shortly. We're just going through the beta testing, and it's really like there's nothing been quite like it before. We've got satellite imaging, so yeah, it's just going to be like $10 a month. I'm trying to keep the price down, but that'll include access to satellite imaging and chlorophyll density and moisture requirements on your paddock and soil tests that are automatically converted to our soil therapy and plant therapy for leaf tests and suggestions on how you can improve and why you need to, and online webinars. And there's even a Ask G-Man, because my nickname is G-Man. So all of my accumulated works, which is over 15,000 pages of my articles and videos and everything I've ever done, has all been put into an AI model. There's a whole human health separate section and a soil health. And you can ask any question and get really, really comprehensive answers. So I've cloned myself. If I die tomorrow, it should all be okay.
Oh, this is wonderful news, Graham. And thank you so much for sharing all your wonderful words of wisdom. And I'll put all your links in with the show notes. So thank you very much for giving up your precious time.
No problems. Nice to chat. Keep up your good work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.